We can begin. Well, look, we have a faithful crew today. This is Wednesday, June 15th. Our concern again is Native American spirituality, and our session will focus on the theme, Earth is Mother. Earth is our mother, as I put it up on the blackboard. I'm Dwayne Addison. Let me just sort of check some things on the board, and we'll move into this and continue some of the things we were talking about yesterday. An image that I'll talk about, we came in to contrast what I think is sort of the, what I would call the Western, especially with the Christian church, about that X is the human being, and the view that the rest of nature is something outside of ourselves, is something that we dominate and seek to control. And the image that comes from many sources, but also from Native American sources, that the human being is at the center. I suspect much closer to the biblical image in Genesis at that point. Along the way, I'll mention a couple names from within our own Western Christian tradition that speak to these issues, and I think they're familiar. Of course, St. Francis, that image of brother and sister nature, that very much a part of that, and I think I mentioned that yesterday, and I wanted to sort of celebrate that. We often sing that hymn that's based upon his Canticle to the Sun. Whatever number that is, I've noted that here again. And he's calling all elements of the creation, including death itself, to join in the praise. And all creatures are able to praise God. And as a way of communicating among us, that we share this sort of thing together. The other name, a contemporary Lutheran theologian, Joseph Sittler, who is now retired, but still with a very active mind, living in Chicago, that for a good generation has spoken to these issues from a Christian perspective. And has called for a new understanding of a care of the earth, new understanding of the first article of the creation. And as far as I know, and I've heard Joe Sittler talk or his readings, I haven't noticed any attention to Native American sources. He says some of the same things that I hope we might get into a little later in our conversation that I will suggest that we may learn here. Two quotes, a part of our concerns that I'll share along the way, and then suggest on Thursday's session, tomorrow's session, I want to go into some of the things we can learn in terms of ethics in the normal sense, lifestyle, in terms of human relationships. For our opening introduction and prayer, let me begin with some material from Black Elk Speaks. Again, this story, the classic, and somebody said it's already sold out of the bookstore. I guess I shouldn't have plugged it so hard, but these are available readily in many places. Black Elk was unknown, you know, one of those holy men among others when Neihardt, the poet, who was sort of trying to recapture poetically the encounter between Indians and Indians on the plains, was directed to this holy man that did not know, one of these old men that had sort of witnessed the massacre at Wounded Knee in 1890, and struck up that acquaintance that was sort of developed. Each knew this was the right person for the right concern. And he said, come back. And so he came back in the spring of 1931. And it begins here, we must prepare. And so for a time of silence, and then this is in the midst of the ceremony of the pipe offering. Before he begins, John Neihardt says to share his story. And he reports there are long sorts of periods of silence each day. He would share some things that would come back to another appropriate time, sort of lost in what he says, that other world. And then he came back. But this is the beginning. In the pipe ceremony, you offer the pipe in terms of gesture, in terms of words, in terms of your being, to the four corners, to the sky, and to the earth. But these four spirits, that is, of the direction of the winds, only one spirit after all. And this eagle feather here is for that one, a part of the decoration, we would say, of the pipe, which like a father. And also it is for the thoughts of men that should rise high as eagles do. Is not the sky a father and the earth a mother, the image we'll pick up today? And are not all living things with feet or wings or roots their children? And this hide upon the mouthpiece here, which would be Beisenheit, is for the earth, from whence we came, and whose breast we suck as babies all our lives, along with all the other peoples or animals, the birds and the trees and the grasses. And because it means all this, and more than this, and more than any man can understand, this pipe is holy. And then a part of the prayer that begins the conversation. After he's addressed the directions, and you, Mother Earth, the only mother, you have shown mercy to your children. Hear me, four quarters of the world, a relative I am. Give me the strength to walk the soft earth, a relative to all that is. Give me the eyes to see and the strength to understand, that I may be like you, that is Mother Earth. With your power only can I face the winds. Great Spirit, my grandfather. All over the earth, the faces of all living things are all alike. With tenderness have these come up out of the ground. Look upon these faces of children without number, and with children in their arms, that they may face the winds and walk the good road to the day of quiet. Let me share some things, and as we've done in the previous days, these sort of affirmations that I sort of see coming out of a variety of Native American traditions, but particularly that of the Plains, to reflect a bit about them and to enter in our own conversation of how we might learn from them. Yesterday we suggested creation is one, but I'll share today is really another way, perhaps we would say a poetic way of talking about the same realities, but to add some new insights, I hope, to it. Or as I borrowed from that phrase from Ella DeLoria, that the creation is the family writ large for her people, the Sioux. And maybe we should look at those sorts of things, what the family is, because the rest of things that are around us are really to be understood in that image of the family. And for her, a Dakota, the obligations of being a member of the family, that's really what the word Dakota or Lakota means, those language terms, is to be allied, and be allied in the sense of being a family member. Because we'll pick up tomorrow, it is not only that blood relationship that has obligations and expectations, but there's the idea of social kinship, that you have rituals or ceremonies that would bring everybody in. But that is not extended only to human beings. It is extended as well to all the other things, animate and inanimate. Kinship is the all-important matter, Ella had said. Here I want to pick up the special relationship with the earth, that upon which we stand and from which we get our life. When we talk about the earth, it is not only the soil, but it includes all that which grows out of the earth, and so is the sense the plants as well as the rocks that are part of that concept of mother. Now that's a common idea from many cultures, and we in the Christian West have sort of resisted this because it is associations with paganism and the history of the biblical story. And biblical people out of the desert, when they came into the land had no sacred qualities because this was the source of idols and of gods, and we've sort of been very careful at this point. But perhaps on the other side, we may also listen. But in many cultures, as well as the Native American, the earth or the ground, for whatever reasons, maybe it seems obvious, has the feminine qualities. And most cultures, or many cultures, have chosen to personify them. Just as the other objects, or some of the others, like the sky and the sun in many cultures, are personified in terms of the male image. It is father's sun, father's sky. And those associations were there. But it is the earth, that upon which we stand and receive our nurture, that I want to lift up today and see what it means. Obviously, if we think about it, I'm a farmer in my roots and come from the Midwest. I appreciate this. The earth is life-giving. We can speak of it meaningfully as caring, as nurturing. or the term that comes up again and again in the language of the ceremonies or Black Elk's prayer here, the earth is merciful. That is a characteristic of the ground upon which we stand. Again, the contrast to our Christian West, or maybe I should say our technological West at that point, that has some Christian roots. We see the earth as inert, as lifeless. It is soil that we can analyze and manipulate, as well as the creatures that sort of grow upon it. These are things, and we treat them accordingly. Again, back to this image that is so basic. We are outside, and we are not a part of it. We're not sisters and brothers, as St. Francis would suggest. But the addition image that's sort of built upon that is lifeless, and we are the only really ones that have life, that is the human beings, in any sense of the word. And so to consider personifying it may be very helpful to us. And so the earth is addressed as mother, or very often as grandmother in the prayers. The sense of honor, of respect for that which has been around, but still the idea of fecundity and of mercy that are there. And again, to connect with the images that we had yesterday, all creatures are sisters and brothers. Again, the language of the ceremonies and the prayers, of the pipe ceremony in particular, that image is there. And life, not only on the human relationships term, but also, we would say, in the ecological dimension, is simply being a good relative. And we'll pick up tomorrow. Being good relatives, you learn from childhood, from the ceremonies, from all the instruction that you receive, is first of all respect. It carries with it obligations, expectations. One of my colleagues who teaches Indian studies at Augustana College, Martin Brokenleg, who has his roots in Lakota life, and he says if somebody comes to your door and gives you the Lakota word for cousin, he says, you're practically helpless. But all of a sudden, all that you've been brought up with, and he has sort of spent much of his time away from the reservation, but it is still there. And you know what that means. Well, you don't know in your head. Your just sort of body responds here. You invite them in. You share. And as the landlords in Sioux Falls know well, that any time you rent a house for Indians, and they only have 6 people in that family, before the week is out, you're probably going to have 20 people. And I can have sympathy for the landlords, but that is rooted in one of these cultural things. But it extends not only to human beings and to your physical relatives, but the idea of cousin is not simply our first cousins in our sense, but to anybody that can claim to be related to you. As Martin suggested, coming from Rosebud Reservation in South Dakota, he's related to half of the reservation by, blood, and if you look at the rest of the reservation, is related by marriage, and that's just as good. And a few other reservations as well, and how do you know? I mean, if they claim you're a relative, you don't dispute that. You welcome that. But I want to come back to that tomorrow. That has some problems in society because it comes out of a society in which things were reciprocal. That you did this and others did that, and the system was a scheme of life that worked, Ella DeLoria said. Sometimes it may not work. Often it does not work in our society in which others do not reciprocate. But here, too, the idea of reciprocity is deeply a part of the idea that Earth is our mother. It means, and perhaps the primary meaning, what it is to be a son or a daughter to that Earth. What are the appropriate forms of respect and care, of filial piety that are for that, and you learn that as well. So you celebrate not only the nurturing of the earth and the soil and the plants, but also it explores our obligations to the earth, the creation that is there. A long time before ecology came around as a scientific thing, and we saw things as matters of a web of life, we could say intuitively or spiritually, the connections were there because I'm a member of a family, and that in family includes the soil, the rocks and the soil upon which I stand. The earth is the caring parent. I am the responding and responsible child. That affirmation, we will pick up some things on it. But one other aspect I wish to lift up on that. The earth is also, very importantly speaking, a model for the woman, particularly the woman as she is developing. For the woman has the greatest power of all. She has the power of life. She is the childbearer. For more than any other, the future is in her hands. And you have that theme again and again. That which will destroy the nation more quickly than any else is for women to lose their virtue, put it in that narrow sense, but that's the sense that is here. Her faithfulness, her style of life, her walk, the passages will say. So her purity is important. Her manner of living is vital, because in one generation the future is lost unless she fulfills that. I recommend, to go far, you know, from the book that I recommended, a marvelous book called Red Man's Religion by Ruth Underhill. She is an anthropologist. I think she's still alive and in her 90s. Most of her adult life lived among Indian people in the Southwest and lives among them, identifies them. Some unsatisfactory sort of things about her book. She speaks as the analytical anthropologist, but still a great deal of insight, and very insightful when she comes to the role of women. You know, because most anthropologists have dealt with North American Indians have been men. She sort of identifies with their concerns and interprets it, I think, very helpfully. But another other source is in the rites themselves. For example, among the traditional Plains Indian people, and the sacred pipe has an illustration of that, of the puberty rite. Or it's called preparing a girl for womanhood. Let me read a couple things to him that, and then a couple comments. One of the seven sacred rites that he wishes to share. These rites are performed after the first menstrual period of a woman. They are important because it is at this time that a young girl becomes a woman. And she must understand the meaning of this change and must be structured in the duties which she is now to fulfill. She should realize that the change which has taken place in her is a sacred thing. For now she will be as Mother Earth and be able to bear children, which should be brought up in a sacred manner. Again and again, the connection with Mother Earth, and that's the pattern and the images that you see and the patterns of life upon Earth, is that the precise image is that of the cherry tree that will come forth and bear beautiful fruit. And just a couple other notes from that ceremony. It is the woman who gives the instruction, by the way, here, which is appropriate. You will now go forth among your people in a holy manner. The woman that has, right after her first menstrual period, that now she is becoming a woman. And you will be an example to them. You will cherish those things which are most sacred in the universe. For you must become as Mother Earth, humble and fruitful. These are the key virtues. May your steps and those of your children be firm and sacred. As Wakantanka, that is the great spirit, the great mysterious, has been merciful to you, so you too must be merciful to others, especially to those children who are without parents. I'm going to pick that note up tomorrow because deeply set in many of the rituals and expectations, the elderly are the first ones in the infirm that are cared for in the matter of the hot. They get the best of the food. If there are any children, and there's sort of very seldom in the traditional society that there'd be any orphans in that, for because there would be the parallel generations, we call the aunts and uncles, that are really parents as well. But especially upon the mother to be that, and the ceremony reminds her that she is to care for all of the needful children in the village. And the ceremony goes on here and says that the very food in your mouth, you know, not too sanitary, according to holding village standards, you know, if that hungry one comes, you share it. That's what it means to be like Mother Earth. A calling. Again, the future depends upon her. To be humble, to be fruitful. Let me share notes, and I have Chief Saddle up here as well, and then we'll be open for conversation in a moment. On our way out here a couple weeks ago, we stopped in Spokane, and we went over to visit the Museum of Native American Cultures that is there, really a very fine museum. And it had this sort of figure that they turned on the projector and the figure looked like it was talking, and they had the speech of Chief Seattle. If you're here in Vespers about a week ago, we had the longer portion of that here. Let me share in this respect, a portion of that speech that speaks to this issue, and his phrase that I think bears much meaning. It is not that the earth belongs to us, but we belong to the earth. That's part of the burden of the idea of the earth as a mother. Chief Seattle, those of you around here know, is commemorated in our Lutheran Book of Worship as one of the Christian saints. His date is June 7th. He became a Catholic, a very devout Christian, and the only Native American listed in those list of heroes of the faith. There could be others, but I'm glad he is there. These words. And the city of Seattle, obviously, is named after him. The sky, the land, which appear changeless and eternal, may change. Now, let me begin just before that. But the earth does not belong to man. Man belongs to the earth. Pardon the sexist language. Whatever happens to the earth belongs to the sons of the earth, or the children of the earth. The sky, the land, which appear changeless and eternal, may change. Continue to follow the earth, and you will achieve an end to living and the mere beginning of survival. You must teach your children that the earth is rich. Teach your children, he's speaking to white persons here, obviously, that to harm the earth is to heap contempt upon its creator. Teach your children what we have taught ours, that the earth is our mother, and that whatever happens to the earth happens to the children of the earth. Love the land as we loved it. Care for it as we have cared for it. Hold in your mind the memory of the land as it was when you found it. And with all your strength and with all your mind and with all your heart, sounds familiar, preserve it for your children and love it as God loves us all. Whatever happens to the earth happens to the children of the earth. Go now, work to do what must be done. We belong to the earth. And then Joe Sittler. How many of you are familiar with personally or the readings of Joseph Sittler? I imagine Joe Sittler is close to 80 now, retired, nearly blind, but one of the most imaginative and creative and poetic minds in theology. I'm not sure what his source is for dealing with it, but as long as I've known him, he's spoken of these themes. It is urgent for Christians, and particularly Lutherans, to conceive and to feel a different relationship with the earth and the world around us. I first came across that, he suggested, and was tromped on for doing that, that we talk about sister nature, not even the idea of mother nature, so that may even be more dangerous. That is, in everything he says, we see that world, particularly the natural world around us, with a sense of awe. Farewell. Hope you get in conversation. Got to go to work. That I've heard him the last time, it was just talking about Chicago, and he loves Chicago, and he says, I love Chicago because you have Lake Michigan there, and they want to sort of block that out, and he said, looking out from where I live, just a few blocks from there he is, and says, I can see that marvelous shoreline. Me, an intimation of the beauty and the power and the creativity of God. That sense of all we need to learn from the earth around us is the messenger of transcendence. Joe Sittler has an old book of sermons in a variety of ways that speak about, the title of the book is The Care of the Earth. In the half dozen or so talks that I've heard from him in the last generation, personally, that theme always comes through. That is a part of the Christian stewardship. Those notes. Affirmations, what can we learn? Several things I would suggest very briefly. Who is, quote, man, the human being, in relationship to the rest of creation? Again, the image that is before us. What can we learn about our understanding of God and God's care for the creation. How do we view the most obvious point? Our treatment of creation, of the earth. Is it true, as I suggested, that we have come with the feeling that the earth is inert, it is lifeless? Therefore, we can dispose of it, we can manipulate it. The idea that it's allowed dominion to become domination, and therefore exploitation. The virtue, not the virtue, but the opposite of it, the vice of arrogance over against that virtue of humility, which just maybe for survival is called forth from us now, or humility and respect. And a fourth element that might be something to learn here, the more deeply that we ought to learn from our scriptures themselves, is about the earth care of us. Maybe that's part of the meaning of the earth as mother, because in most societies and ours, it is the woman, the mother, who has had the qualities of caring and nurture. And just to appreciate that and what it generates in terms of love, to actually love the earth, that's not heretical, and to give thanks. Like St. Francis in that hymn that's based upon his canticle to the sun. All creation is called forth to express that exuberant love and joy and thanksgiving. And the burden is most especially upon the human part of creation. What can we learn? Those are some suggestions. Where would you like to take it? What issues to affirm and explore?
One area that I see quite a contrast with is with the young woman who reaches puberty. It's quite a contrast to how we handle that. We say a little bit about, well, you know, now this means that you'll be able to be a mother someday, but I think we tend to put it in a negative thing, that this is going to be a big inconvenience that you're going to have to deal with, you know, regularly the rest of your life, you know, that kind of thing. I think the negative part comes out so much more. And also, now you'll have to be careful. You know, men will be out after you, you know, kind of thing. And to be, you know, protect yourself and take care, kind of thing, rather than be given that this is, what were the two aspects of it that the Indian girl was given, like
humble and fruitful.
And I don't think any of that kind of thing is
That means you're reaching womanhood now to be humble and fruitful. To be careful.
You know, the curse is what they used to call it. I don't think we have quite that literal with our young girls these days. But
yeah, but today's society, it's a little hard to tell 12-year-old or 11, 12-year-old this type of thing, you know, but now, you know, they're a woman, you know, not something fruitful. Perhaps in the time, you know, the girls were married quite very lot younger.
Yeah, when you're 12 or 13,
I mean,
you don't really have to become.
Probably you were married off to somebody.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, to whatever age, you know, you didn't have much choice probably. You probably were married off and started to bear children at that age.
You don't dare tell your daughter to be humble anymore either.
Not unless the parents are ready to be humble too.
Well, in part, at least they'll have to feel humble that through you new life can come. If we could at least make it seem more a specialized condition that is given you, you know, that, you know, this possibility of being fruitful and being able to bring life. But I just have a hunch that most of us never experienced that approach to our coming of age.
I was wondering, do they have any special ceremonies specifically on this birth as our mother theme?
The only one nearest to it that I'm aware of is, you know, the ceremony for the women. And I know I've talked to people in South Dakota, for example, and that, you know, that ceremony is, you know, not used anymore. And I don't know whether some of those values are sort of, you know, even there anymore, not in this area. it's just an image that comes through again and again of the language, the prayer, the traditional sorts of stories. And I may be wrong at this point, especially with these sort of qualities and virtues as related to the earth. You know, unless you're in the more traditional societies of the Southwest, may be largely lost in Indian community too, as well as they're lost to us.
I don't recall it being a big part of the, but then being different, you know, Indian culture too. I mean, in the Southwest, I'm about your plains. In the Southwest, they've integrated so much to that. They got three major, really major groups down there. Navajo, especially, been taking over. We understand it from geological studies they've done. Well, used to be smaller tribes.
Yeah.
Actually, the Navajo took them over.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Took what few people there were because of pottery shards that they found that they're showing up in, you know, present day pottery. So you know that somewhere along the line, somebody, you know, had to have brought that with them.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the only, you know, remains of. So now you got three different, but they're all sort of different in a way and yet alike. I unfortunately never did get over to see their big days at the Grants area where they do a lot of their, you live in a place for a long time, you think, oh, I'm going to get there next year.
Mm-hmm.
And next year.
Yeah.
This Earth is Our Mother reminds me of an issue that's, I guess it's sort of on the wane here in the Pacific Northwest, but it was a pretty hot issue for a while, and that's the Indian fishing rights.
Yeah.
And there's,
that cooled down, huh?
Beg your pardon?
Has that cooled down, or just sort of below the surface?
Well, I don't know. I don't really follow it that closely. You know, after a while, I get a little burned out about reading who is really a good steward or not. You know,
yeah.
I'm not a fisherman, and I fish for salmon occasionally, as you know, just for recreation. But you know, I hear people saying, "Well, the Indian has not been a good steward," and then of course, then the white man has all the high technology. And then, what, I don't know, 6 months ago or sometime last year, several Indians were arrested for engaging in an extensive poaching operation on the Columbia River. And there were many, many thousands of fish were involved.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering, what is the issue with the Plains Indians in South Dakota as far as white man versus Indian? And his relationship with the earth. Is there a point of contention or friction like there has been here in the Pacific Northwest?
Well, the issue that's sort of been most present is that of jurisdiction, who controls, you know, the land there. And most of the reservations there are checkerboarded, and although they're within the boundaries of the reservation, and, you know, the tribal government has some control, much of the land there is actually operated by white ranchers, is the truth, in South Dakota.
Well, the Black Hills.
And then that's the other issue I was going to say, that there's a group led primarily, not only, but I think primarily by Indian people raising the question, how do we treat the Black Hills? You know, it's something, one voice, you know, there's confusion of voices on that. You know, this belongs to the Indians, and what that means, you know, is a number of ways of saying that. But one of the ways in which that spoke is the Black Hills ought to be preserved in terms of their beauty, and it's something for all people, and that you know, it is sort of a leading voice in preventing the Black Hills from being exploited.
Mine is
a fear in terms of mining and development. And it's like here, the great majority of the Black Hills, if you get off the path, there's a kind of virginal sort of beauty, and you know, the tourists can recognize this, and fear that this will become one of the areas. And so you have the Black Hills Alliance, which has both people's naturalist bent, it has sort of farmers and ranchers, but also Native Americans here for protecting the Black Hills and their future, in a symbolic way of protecting all our wilderness areas.
Well, didn't the U.S. Pay back people of Indian ancestry because the treaty was not done right or something, where we supposedly bought it from the Indian people?
But that has not been accepted by Indian tribes yet. This is the grout of, you know, the Supreme Court has recognized that the Black Hills were taken illegally. And I think they paid, was it $17 million for them, plus the interest over all those years, and the settlement for $105 million. Mm-hmm. and there's division within the Indian community about how that's, you know, whether they should accept it, because that would, you know, extinguish any claim for the hills, and some says we, in principle, we should never accept it. Others say that's all we're going to get, let's use that and use it, you know, either individually, or some will say in terms of development, in terms of dealing with the real problems that we have, in terms of alcohol and disease and hunger and development on the reservation. And so that's come out of the Black Hills claim.
Yeah, I was wondering, I'm sure because of this Mother Earth kind of thing, that they have a great affinity for the land. Of course, that's where they got their living in the past. But somehow that doesn't seem to me that, from what I know about the Indian thing, that they, at least in the majority, are very flexible. They change, you know, they want, what good is all this acres and acres, say the Southwest Desert? I mean, you can't even grow sheep, you know, on the
Yeah, farm. It takes quite a few acres. You
know, I know, I've been sheep. Over all of it. And,
you know, and they've been overgrazed.
So, you know, there's nothing there. But they're great on this land, and yet there's a thing, there's no mineral there, even, you know, a lot of it's absolutely, you know, nothing. I mean, there's nothing.
Well, coal and mineral country, but that.
I just, they, you know, they hang on to this, and yet, like you say, if they rob of this huge sum of money, maybe they could, you know, take it and do something with their own lives, and to like we're talking about, but yes, the men, you know, have not apparently been able to assimilate themselves into, you know, general society and find a place.
Mm-hmm.
And what are the people who teach them or educate them, what are they telling them to? I mean, to get them into an attitude, different attitude, not the way they're back, you know, they're religious or whatever you want to call this spirituality thing. But I'm sure they can keep that at the same time, you know, be, you know, some productive member of society, whether it's on the reservation or whether it's off the reservation. And this is where I see the breakdown of the Indian thing, you know, is that they apparently seem a lot of them unwilling to change. But we did this for, you know, so many years.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure in those years there was evolution also. You know, there hadn't been change all the way too.
Yeah.
They went from roaming probably to you know, more settled communities, say like the Pueblos, you know, were, you know, more of a settled type of a community. I don't know. I just feel that somewhere on the line, someone has to get through to them.
Mm-hmm. What others speak to that?
I was just wondering just now if in the heritage of the Indians, if this concept of the oneness with the earth is so interwoven with their heritage that it's not that easy to give up that in their lifestyle, where for many of us, a lot of this isn't, the oneness isn't there, so we can easily adapt and change and move on to other things because we start living kind of compartmental lives, and it really isn't that important to us.
Yeah.
We give up things easier. Maybe that is, or maybe that isn't it.
You know, what do you think? Is it still a factor? I think in the past it has been a major factor. The way you raise the question whether it's a sort of a helpful or a negative factor or destructive factor. No.
Well, I'd rather see us learn a little bit more about their point of view than to expect them to give up their feeling about it.
What are the answers, and what direction you talked about, you know, what sort of things can be taught, or maybe some things raised questions, and what sort of things raised up in their own traditions there. But I go around the areas, you know, around Phoenix, for example, and see these reservations, there are thousands of years of Indian agriculture that are there, that sort of set the pattern for the canals and what became this great agricultural area around Phoenix and the irrigation. The tradition before it, because, you know, the mountain snows run off to these rivers, and those have been used and for that. But if you go there, that would be the Gila River, south of Phoenix, for example, and you can tell exactly where the Indian reservation begins and the non-Indian territory is near the Gila River. It's the Gila River Reservation. You know, for whatever the reasons are, the crops, you know, crops that are growing there are very productive and beautiful in the agricultural area. This is a commercial, non-Indian operations. The reservation comes, it's sagebrush. It is there. It is almost no development. And I've asked people there that have known the history of some of the people on the reservation, and they said, neither from our own people nor from those who have worked with us in the Bureau of Indian Affairs or the Department of Agriculture has there ever been much encouragement or direction to develop the land, even though that was their history hundreds of years ago, that there was a way of taking that dry land and making it prosper. And what is it? Is that that when these rivers were dammed, that the waters by a variety of political means went to the developers who were non-Indian farmers? Does that mean that the Indian people themselves did not seize the opportunity to develop themselves because they could do just as well by leaving, in terms of that dependency relationship on the federal government? And a very complicated sort of thing. And what does that mean for the future? I would feel personally that for, quote, the Indian problem to be solved, quote unquote, you require, if the reservation, for example, is to be a viable sort of thing, that there be development, it becomes something that sort of thrives largely by itself. And relatively few reservations are able to do that now. And the survival of these ways and so forth, I think, is connected with that as well. Maybe others can speak to this. Yeah.
I don't know what the solution is. I don't even
I don't
know.
Even. The more I know, the harder it is.
I don't even really know that much about it. I just have a general feeling that separating people from one another is a bad thing. And so I just sort of inside think that a reservation system is not necessarily the answer, separating people from one another. And I think that, times change. Things change, and things don't go backwards. And the white people are not going to all go back to Europe and leave this North American continent back to the Native Americans. So I think somehow we need to learn to function together. Yeah. Now, the agricultural thing, they should maybe be able to develop that, work their way into commercial agriculture and providing vegetables or fruits or whatever. On the coast of Washington now, the Quinault Indians are developing canneries.
And is that going pretty well?
I don't know. When I worked for an engineering company about 8 years ago that was helping set that up. Mm-hmm. And one of them had a big fire, did they? It was destroyed by fire or something. Yeah, it wasn't very long ago. And I don't know if the canneries will be open just for Indian fishermen or for all fishermen, but it would seem that it would be a pretty good business to get into and be open to both, to all fishermen to set up a cannery and not just can fish. And if that's sort of your, if fishing is your background, that's a modern way to use it to background.
Yeah.
And maybe things like that could be worked. I don't know.
Well,
I just don't like the idea of people, any people, sitting off by themselves muttering, life is awful. I mean, look what these people have done to us. Try to get out of that and try to function in with the rest of everyone else.
But there seem to be other ways that the culture gets in the way of that kind of cooperation, because the Western style of operating a cannery, is pretty much a lockstep operation. It's probably like running a dishwasher up here that I had to learn how to do lately. And you do this and this and this and this in that order. And everybody puts in so many hours, and they show up at a certain time and leave at a certain time. Many of these kinds of things that they try using a large workforce of Native American peoples, and I think this is very common among many tribes, that they just don't adapt to that way of working. So you'd run into those kind of problems of having...
Maybe having our work ethic, which means sort of buying in our sense of time and sort of working to save and to do the things
If there's something better to do then at that particular time of day, they're likely to... maybe they have somebody comes to them and needs them, and they'll just leave and take care of that and not be concerned about meeting some kind of production schedule or something. So there would always be those kinds of things, even if it's ultimately to their best interest to learn how to use their fishing as a means of improving their.
I just don't understand that much. I'm just so steeped in the business way of life, you know, the American way of business life or whatever it is, that's really hard for me to understand and to cope with or to deal with. And I look at the Chinese who were brought over here and worked on the railroads. They just sort of assimilated right in and set up their own communities, but are now all over the United States and just function as Americans. They just don't restrict themselves to their Chinese communities in large cities. They're in the suburbs and they're just out everywhere.
But the Chinese chose to do that. They came over here because they saw the money is the need.
Well, not well. Did they?
Yep.
When they came as railroads, or were they just?
No, a lot of them were sent over by their, you know, relatives. So a lot of them were essentially slaves.
A lot of them came because they had nothing in China, and they got over here.
Same reason some of our ancestors probably came.
They were essentially slaves in the railroad. They paid them very little for.
Yeah.
A lot of them died on those, you know, crews. The money they made, most of them sent it back home to support their families. But you know, they have managed to keep. I have a Japanese friend, and there's a lot of Chinese folks in Portland area. You get a lot of them. And they keep their culture, you know, they keep their homes, they have their shrines, everything, but yet they mainstream into life. But at the same time, they do have their own culture.
Yeah.
A lot of them, of course, it's like anything else, you know, I mean, even the church, you know, the children, you know, want to stay with that or go with, a lot of them become Christian, you know, but it depends. A lot of them still are Buddhist and whatever, you know, they have maintained this, and that's why she said that they don't adapt. And I don't think the Indian is any different than any other human being, that you can adapt to your surroundings. You know, I mean, that would be a put down almost to say that they can't adapt, because I don't, you know, but that's to say that they're less, you know, because people already say that in the Southwest, so you know, you.
But in their adapting, they're giving up something that, you know, they have a different priority in terms, and their gen, we maybe ought to learn from them a little bit, is that humans and relationships and so forth is more important than making it in the stock market or something.
Well, sense of value.
Yeah.
That may be true, okay? They're so concerned about their human connection, one to the other, and yet they have this tremendous infant mortality. And their own lifespan is so short because of their hygiene problems, or you know, they die at the age of 40 from tuberculosis or whatever. And for me, as a white person, I had very little sympathy for those people after they've had all this thing available to them to prevent them from having this high infant mortality. I don't know. That's why it's difficult for me to have a lot of sympathy for. A group that will allow themselves to be this way. Because I don't think I'm doing it to them. Maybe I am, but I can't see that. I don't understand that I am doing that to them, which sometimes I've been told that, you know, I am doing it to them, or the white man's doing this to them. We're murdering their babies. I just can't buy into that. I find it difficult to be accused of being a polluter when if you go to a many Indian reservations, the pollution is horrible. I mean, you know.
Yeah, that I'm aware of. I speak with some of the
reservations.
It's like he talked about agriculture. You go across it, just riding down the highway in New Mexico or Arizona or someplace, and you know when you cross the line of an Indian reservation without agriculture. Because immediately, you know, you see the clutter and everything. And I often told my husband to drive by, I said, you know, the Indians, it's their land, and they always say that they like it so well, and yet you look at it, and they defile it more than, in a way, I feel, than anybody.
Just a little glimpse of the lack of accepting modern medicine as such. Reading some of the books that Brad and Tangier write, the people who live in northern Canada, and they write about how to live in the wilderness and such.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about their relationships with Indians, and they're sick often. ear infections and stuff. Well, if they get cough medicine, which is often flavored, they use it on their pancakes. Tastes good, so they use it as a syrup on their pancakes. Then when they need it, of course, they don't have it. And if it is a prescription-type medicine, they probably develop immunity to the medicine. That sort of thing. How do you break that kind of cycle? How do you get through that kind of wall? Who built that wall? Did we build that wall? Did they build that wall? I don't understand.
I think that wall, I think, was mutually built. Maybe, you know, a lot of things before our time. And I think the walls have to come down. I think we are one people. We have one future. I think they have to mutually be brought down. I'm aware, and part of my work with the National Indian Lutheran Board, it's probably only a drop in the bucket, that one of their major endeavors over the last 10 years is to assist self-help projects and to monitor those and provide seed money for other groups to come in. Because in many reservations in Indian communities, there are efforts to break through this, to be sensitive to, you know, the lifestyles and the limitations are there, but to take charge of their future. And in most places, that's why I say, you know, the mutual sort of thing, you've had a style of life in which the decisions were made for you, that dependency relationship, whether it's financial or political or a variety of sorts of ways, a very unhealthy relationship, paternalism is the way we would call that. And we have that heritage in which people have not taken responsibility for themselves. Each of these issues that I looked at, where I look at this sort of, the desert, in the negative sense, in the midst of fertile fields in the Pima Papago, the Gila River Reservation, or the same thing as here in, I've seen in South Dakota, that the land is there, who ranches it? White ranchers come in, and they are that, they've taken over, and the Indian people, well, they can just turn over the BIA and they do their land. But at the same time, in the last decade, I've seen a tremendous amount of efforts in trying, uphill battles, to take charge to do those sorts of things. And I would see a part of the role of the churches, an important role of the governments, is to open doors, provide sort of wise assistance, not locked in into that dependency relationship that would enable these things to happen. In some places, those things can happen. Many reservations, majority of them, if you think about it in terms of geography, were put on those areas that are remote from transportation. They are often the most arid lands, and a lot of things are moved there, and there's no way that they'll be economically productive in some cases. At the same time, we're aware that probably half our uranium reserves are in Indian-controlled land. The water in the west, the great coal deposits that have not been developed, great tourist lands, and the many varieties, and I think, and fishing in Washington, apart from the controversy here with on the salmon.
Also, Oregon has that problem with fishing, too.
They do, too.
It's all the rivers and things that have any salmon or Chinook steel or whatever. It's all a controversial subject in Oregon also.
And I've seen reasons for modest Indian people in South. I go to South Dakota reservations, and there's nobody there that has the skills in management or business, apart from the what we all call values and lifestyle in terms of work. There's just know-how of setting up a business and dealing with it.
You were talking about mineral rights, and I saw a TV show once where the Indians were being totally exploited by the people who wanted their minerals. So they just treat them as being dumb and stupid, and they don't give them dignity. So it's a lot of our
A lot of history for it. We drove through your present area the first time that I've been through there at the Northern Cheyenne Reservation and the Crow Reservations in southeastern Montana. Fantastic wealth in terms of coal deposits in those reservations. And I know the story that the Indians have been there protected and guided by a Bureau of the Government, the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And the story is there when this coal was discovered, the amount of return for the Indian community was fantastically small. And the great coal companies like Peabody Coal, that was a bonanza. And that story has happened again and again. Those are beginning to change. And I don't know what the story is, because you have huge coal developments in the Four Corners area of Arizona and know, that in the country. Iranian people are beginning to get some of the benefits and take control of that sort of situation where there are resources. I'm not sure where that's going to go myself, but you know, that is potential.
It sounds like they don't have management buildings over. They need a lot more education.
And education.
They don't suddenly become, you know, yeah, able to write a set of books and so forth. You know.
I often wonder though. I know that the Indians have. We have some people in our culture have a very romantic idea of what the Indians are and what they stand for, and. What's to say that I don't know a whole bunch about the modern culture, modern Indian reservations and what's going on there, but I'm not totally convinced that our way is correct and that they have to learn our ways.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just not convinced that sure we may have a longer lifespan or we may have less infant mortality, but who's to say that everything we do is all wonderful and hunky-dory, and therefore everyone else should learn it.
Yeah. And I think America means aren't part of choice. You'd have different sort of lifestyles, you know, that these sort of should be open. And I think that is the part of the concern, too. Yeah.
There's a question, too, of the ideals or the values, stated values of the Indian culture, similar to our stated values of our Christian culture. How many of us really live up to what our Christian values,
yeah,
and way of life tell us? And same way the Indians probably falling very short, getting away from their the values that Chief,
yeah,
Seattle and some of the others, the leaders have expounded and taught. And so we both have a lot to learn within our own culture, as well as trying to negotiate and come up to some kind of terms with the other culture.
I was curious as to the population. I always think that somehow or other I see the Indian as diminishing. Maybe that's not true, but
no, it isn't.
Isn't it?
Very rapid population increase. That you live among the Navajo, people are worried the Navajo are going to take over
mm-hmm.
Arizona. On that, the latest population figures are 1980 population 1.4 million. You know, that's not big. You know, it's less than 1.5% of the country. And the official population for 1970 was just under 800,000.